Hello, and welcome to the third episode of Underworld. My guest for this episode is Gina DeVries. She is a much-published writer of erotica and the curator of Sphinx, which is spelled S-F-I-N-X and stands for San Francisco in Exile. It's a series of erotica readings and performances, because readings really doesn't cover the kind of things that people do while they're reciting what they've written. Okay, so this will be the first in a series of interviews with the Underworld's TNG, the Next Generation, if you're a Star Trek fan. I wanted to do these interviews so that you wouldn't get the idea that everybody who did anything important or interesting was over 40 or over 50 in some cases. And some of these interviews will be with people who've accomplished a lot and have a lot to say. But these TNG interviews, they will be with the voices of younger people to see where they are taking the issues of sexual and gender identity, because I think a lot of the things that they're saying and doing are extremely interesting. This interview is also the first of the series to be conducted at the Center for Sex and Culture, an education and performance venue in San Francisco that occupies a large industrial space on Mission Street. I mention it because it gives these conversations a sort of characteristic echoey sound, as well as the occasional traffic noises in the background, so you can get the idea. So, without further delay, here's the conversation with Gina DeVries. I was hoping that we'll start out with a little bit of your background.
Okay.
Every time I look at one of your bios, it starts out with you talking about how you came out as a lesbian when you were 11.
Those are the old bios.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, see, this is the problem.
I guess if you Google me.
Yeah, I was going to say, I Google your name and I come up with these bios. And, you know, now we've reached the stage where everything is immortal on the web. Yeah. For the old bios.
Yeah.
You came out as a lesbian when you were 11. Which raises the immediate questions about sexual identity.
Yeah.
So, you want to talk about your early... you self-define now as bisexual?
Bisexual and queer.
And just queer in general?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, how did you come to that? Did you always identify as bisexual?
I think that I always identified as queer, and growing up in San Francisco with, you know, sort of liberal, hippie, bohemian parents and being exposed to a lot of folks in the gay community pretty young, it was fairly easy for me to figure out what was going on when I was in middle school, and fairly easy for me to come out in that way. For my early adolescence, I really was mostly interested in girls, so lesbian seemed to fit. It was just later on in high school. I think it was both that I was noticing an attraction to men and to trans folks and people who didn't identify as women, that was kind of becoming more feeling like something that I should be dealing with and not hiding. And also, was involved in a lot of queer political circles where there was this very specific bisexual politic. And I think that both of those things just made it easier and enabled me to come to that identity.
To come to a bisexual identity explicitly?
Yeah.
You see, this is one of the things that I noticed about the sexual revolution that sort of went on in the 90s, here in the Bay Area at least, in California, on the West Coast here in this Pan-Pacific culture, was that there was this convergence of queerness, the emergence of the queer identity as distinct from gay, straight, bisexual.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that has to do with the emergence of the gender identity movement.
Mm-hmm.
The transgendered people, the sense of public identity as being transgender.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we began noticing was that we were attracted to certain masculine and feminine principles, and that those were quite often separate from the actual physical expression of the person. In other words, you could say, I'm attracted to femininity, and that means you could be attracted to...
And that means femininity could come in a whole variety of packages.
From a boy or from a girl or anything.
Right.
So that's why we started... I think that's why people began searching for a new term that was beyond the binary.
Yeah, it's interesting for me. I feel like, on the one hand, queer encompasses so much more of who I am than bisexual does, but I also really cling to the label bisexual because I feel like, particularly in dyke communities, there's been this kind of recent sort of sweeping under the rug of anything bi, and I think that that's because, you know, queer means you're revolutionary, and bi means that you're binary, it means that you sleep with men, and there's all this sort of sticky stuff in there around this trans politic of like, well, it's okay for dykes to fuck trans men, but it's not okay for dykes to fuck non-trans men, and that to me, particularly as someone who's had a lot of trans guy lovers, it's like, so what does that mean? Does that mean the trans men aren't men? What is that saying?
You know? Exactly.
It's tricky. I mean, I think, yes, like, bisexual, you know, comes from bi, comes from binary, like, yes, there's a problem with that. I understand that politically. I also feel like so much of my personal sexual politic was influenced by this bi movement that was claiming the word and also really into smashing all those binaries, so... You know, I think there's possibility for both and.
Yeah, I worked on that magazine, Anything That Moves.
Yeah, that's how I first became familiar with your work.
Ah, send you over to me. Yeah, I find myself clinging to a bisexual identity as well, simply because I have all this leftover resentment from the last 10 years of people wanting to claim any identity other than bisexual.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, people go, well, most memorably, I went to... a film festival where the director, the woman who directed the film, was there. It was about a lesbian who fell in love with a man, and it wasn't Chasing Amy, but it was one of those movies that came after.
Yeah,
and she insisted that we refer to the director insisted that we refer to the main character not as bisexual but as queer. You know, so that we said, well, why didn't she? She said she was a lesbian when she was only sleeping with women, but when she started sleeping with men and women, she said she was queer. Why didn't she say bisexual? And then the woman said, oh, well, by that point, bisexual was just a label.
That's really interesting. So queer isn't a label.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. In this bisexual case. Is a label, queer is an identity. Or no, I've noticed that, and it's really, you know, again, it's tricky to me because I see where there are problems with the word, but I also think that. That so much of the kind of sweeping under the rug of bisexuality or of, you know, choosing any label but bi, somehow I don't think that that really has to do with, you know, oh, smash the state, smash the binary. Like, I really think that a lot of what that's about is just biphobia and that people can kind of dress it up and make it cutesy and make it look like it's radical choice and... You know, and it's like, if the word really doesn't fit you, okay, the word doesn't fit you. I'm not, you know, demanding that every person who has sort of sexual attractions or experiences of people of more than one gender cling to the word bi, but it's really interesting to me that it's the word that everybody avoids.
Yeah, it's the silly identity.
Yeah.
You know, you can people take you seriously if you're gay or if you're a lesbian.
Right.
Or if you're queer, but if you say I am bisexual, the automatic assumption is that you're a lightweight intellectually, and that you're silly, or you're not as serious as a person.
Right.
And, you know, of course, then it doesn't help a lot that the word bisexual, most of the people who claim the word bisexual in my experience are men who are cheating on their wives. Which pretty much fits the definition of a gay man in the closet clinging to heterosexual privilege.
Right.
You know, wanting to have sex whenever they feel like it, you know, with what turns them on, but not wanting to take any of the
privilege away. No, it's interesting for me. I mean, part of when I was coming out as bi in high school, and I grew up in the Ingleside in San Francisco, and you know, Ingleside is sort of this interesting, like, mostly like sort of working class, lower middle class, like very mixed race neighborhood, and, you know, I went to the like local Catholic school there. And then for high school, I was on scholarship at the Urban School, which is this, like, really fancy, hippie school, basically. It was this interesting mix of, like, you know, we called our teachers by their first names and, like, sat in circles and talked about our feelings, but it was also a prep school, you know, so, like, 10 kids got sent to the Ivy Leagues every year.
Yeah.
And, you know, because it was sort of this, like, you know, hippie, like, you know, high school Montessori, like, junior Hampshire College type thing, like... There was this whole sense of we're going to be good San Francisco liberals, and there was to a degree this acceptance of female bisexuality, but it was also like I definitely felt apart from those girls, because I felt like my experience of bisexuality was so from this queer perspective and this queer community perspective, and I was out. I was always out about everything, and, you know, these were the girls who, like, being, you know, quote-unquote being bisexual was something kinky that you do for your boyfriend, mm-hmm. and you do it at a party when you're drunk, and, yes. you know, then you go back to your straight little life, and that... Yeah, just that, like, that not letting go of those privileges.
Yeah.
And that refusal.
The performative bisexuality.
Yeah.
You know, where the girls make out with each other, but absent the male gaze, they would never have any sexual feelings for each other.
Right.
Or at least they would never admit
to it. Or they would never admit to it.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the other interesting thing. I mean, like, because I was a queer youth activist, I, you know, was sort of the person that everyone, you know, in middle school and in high school came to, like, with their various sexual anxieties, and, you know, and a lot of that was like, oh, I have these feelings, but I can't do anything about them, and, yeah.
So you got to talk to the people about that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, that sort of informed your early life and your early choices.
Mm-hmm.
And you went from there. Where did you go to college?
I went to Hampshire College.
Hampshire College.
It's in Amherst, Massachusetts.
Yeah. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you rather than any of the other people I know from the queer and bi community was because of the activism you've done around your artwork,
mm-hmm.
your writing, and the sort of the groups and the shows you've put together, mm-hmm. and things like that. When did you first start writing, and when did you first start, when did that sort of become a public performance
right.
sort of activity?
I started writing as soon as I could, really. You know, I was one of those kids who was, like, making little newspapers and, like, little magazines, you know, when I was, like, 6, 7, and, like, handing them out to my friends and my family kind of thing. You know, the Ashton Avenue Express or whatnot.
Yeah. Queer News.
And when I got more interested in self-publishing, sort of through my involvement in queer youth activism and Riot Girl. It's funny, I was just looking through this book, Girl Power, today by Hillary Carlip, and there's a chapter on Riot Girls, and that's actually sort of how I found out that Riot Girl was this thing that, like, young women around the country were doing and that mm-hmm. I could do. And pretty soon after that, I was at a queer youth lobby day. This was in 1997 in Sacramento. Lyric, which is the queer youth organization in San Francisco, mm-hmm. bussed a bunch of us up for the lobby day. And I met a couple of kids there who were doing zines. So I got really into zine culture from that, sort of trading zines from, like, kids all over the country. And
for people who don't know, zines were the printed form of podcasting from 10 years ago, or 15 years ago.
Kind of.
It was homemade magazines instead of homemade radio shows.
Yeah, I mean, homemade magazines, kind of like homemade little diaries that you would publish. It's interesting to see, like, how many people who were zinesters are now bloggers and vice versa.
And podcasters.
Yeah,
and
podcasters.
Like, yeah, I used to work for Bill Brent, who, of course, published Magazine, the book. And he
published Magazine?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
He wrote it and published it, yeah. He ran Black Books.
I knew about Black Books and Black Sheets. I didn't know about Magazine.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, he did. And so he was big in the zine scene back then, and that was how I ended up probably here in San Francisco, mm-hmm. was from one of his zines that crossed over into the semi-professional world, which was Black Sheets Magazine. And that's where I learned about what was going on in this city when I was looking for a place to go when it was time to change my life.
Yeah.
So, and I'm interested in Riot Girl itself. I don't know that much about it.
Yeah.
But I've always had this sense that that early ideas about queerness and queer identity sort of informed the Riot Girl sensibility.
Definitely, definitely. It's funny, actually. As I think we're going to talk about later, I curate shows for San Francisco in Exile, and our next show is actually going to be a Riot Girl nostalgia show.
Yeah. Oh, have we gotten to that point?
We have, yeah, yeah. At least for folks who are, like, in their mid-20s and up.
Gosh.
Yeah, it's sort of, yeah, queer sensibility in Riot Girl. I mean, at least in the girl circles that I was running in, you know, almost everybody was queer, and it was sort of one of those people were assumed to be queer unless they told you otherwise kinds of things. It's funny, I mean, it definitely wasn't separatist, and it was definitely, you know, so much about kind of eschewing parts of second wave feminism that didn't work for us, but there was also sometimes a little bit of this, like, feminism is the theory, lesbianism is the practice stuff.
Yeah.
You know, with this sort of, like, you know, kind of spun on its head, like, very punk edge, but that's sort of a lot of how it works, which is funny to me in retrospect.
Yeah. It wasn't, I mean, when Riot Girl did reach the mainstream, when it was sort of regarded by the mainstream media, the connection wasn't made with queer identity.
Yeah.
The women that were being interviewed and profiled on, like, these magazine shows on television, that nobody said these are lesbians.
Right.
You were sort of left to make that connection on your own if you were hip to what was going on. But it seemed pretty obvious to, you know, the rest of us that were queer.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? You know, that this was an offshoot of the lesbian feminist concept or sensibility.
Right. Right.
So it was in college that you started curating shows?
Yes. I mean, I started performing in high school. I started doing zines and performing in high school and curating shows in college. I was back here for a summer. It was summer of 04. Yeah, it was. And I ran into Sarah Moore, who was one of the co-founders of San Francisco in Exile at another art showing for National Queer Arts Festival, and she and I had met like 10 years previous at a lyric thing, actually. So she pulled me aside and, you know, was telling me that she was doing stuff with San Francisco in Exile and asking if I wanted to do a show. And I was really interested. So I started curating with Sphinx, with Sarah, when I was back in San Francisco.
So for people who don't know what, when we talk about curating a show, we're talking about putting on a reading, getting a venue, gathering some people together, and then getting some writers, usually people who have limited publication, usually not people that are nationally famous or have novels out or anything. It's sort of the same inside scene. You know, we're back to the zinesters and the podcasters and the general underground, you know, edge culture. You get those people together, you get a group of people together, and you get a venue and you advertise a little bit and people come and you just read. You read your poetry, your erotica, or sometimes there's music and sometimes there's a dance, but mostly it's a writer's scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and mostly it's a prose writer's scene.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about SF in Exile, which you refer to as Sphinx, S-F-I-N-X.
Yeah.
This is the show that you curate, that you organize. How many shows have you done with these?
I've done, let's see, Cherry, Bombshell, Home for the Holidays. So this upcoming one will be my fifth.
The fifth one.
Yeah.
Okay. And you've been doing this for 5 years.
Well, I've been sort of guest curating with Sphinx since, I guess, 2004. So 4 years. And I've been head curator only since winter of 07.
Yeah. When you say curator, that's, you know, that's like saying producer, organizer, host, MC.
I guess, yeah.
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 And I it was passed down to me by Sarah Moore, who's a really fabulous writer and sort of show producer, like host extravaganza here in San Francisco. And she and Chris Kobik started together in 2001.
So and I just saw one of the Sphinx shows, which was pretty good. It was fabulous.
Thank you.
Was it last week or 2 weeks ago?
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. And that was, which one was that one?
That was just the Best of Sphinx.
Best of Sphinx.
Yeah.
So you tried to get writers that had appeared at
Tried to get a mix of writers who had appeared at Sphinx events before and writers who were new to Sphinx, so I'd like to incorporate more into what we do.
And so, the general concept is, when you say in exile, what does that mean?
I mean, I think that this is going to be me more talking about Sarah and Chris's vision.
Mm-hmm.
But their vision was for there to be an art space. They were starting Sphinx right around the time that there was a lot of dot-com boom and that a lot of sort of queers and outcasts and artists who were living in the city were having to move out. And a lot of the idea of Sphinx coming together and happening was around keeping the art scene thriving and making sure that stuff just didn't disappear.
Where else have you been published?
Let's see. Thinking about recent publications. Well, I did a reading for More 5-Minute Erotica last night.
Mm-hmm.
Carol Queen's new erotica anthology, which is really sweet. And did a reading with Writers with Drinks, which is Charlie Anders' event. She publishes Other Magazine a couple weeks ago. That was really fun.
I noticed that you were on the bill with like Armistead Maupin.
Yep, that was fun.
Yeah. the writer of Tales of the City. Which that is sort of a large literary figure here in San Francisco. A gay man, but definitely outside the queer scene.
Yeah.
As far as you know, mainstream acceptance.
Yeah. He's a funny one in that. I mean, I think that he's definitely more mainstream in terms of how widely his work is read. And I've also, like, I like his stuff. And the last book of his that I read, like, he was definitely talking about queer identities that weren't just gay. So, I mean, I appreciate that about him.
Yeah. And this was part of Writers with Drinks, which is a writers a reading series that's hosted, that's curated by Charlie Girl Anders, a noted trans person, and the editor and publisher of Other Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
You've got coming up another Sphinx show. And which is what is the Riot Girl Nostalgia Show?
Yes.
And when is that?
That's August 23rd.
August 23rd. And do you know where that's going to be?
That is probably, crossing my fingers, going to be at the Center for Sex and Culture. There's been a little bit of space.
Yeah, there's always a lot of issues around space and venues to perform here in the city. As things have gotten tighter and tighter, there's just even empty storefronts become hard to come by.
Although I will say that Center for Sex and Culture and The Garage, which is Joe Landini's space on Howard, mm-hmm. have been really excellent. And Sphinx has definitely been able to bounce back between those spaces.
I remember reading in one of the biographies that I was looking at.
The internet.
You talked about mentors, having older mentors, mm-hmm. for your sense of identity.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that, about your early life and how you sort of developed your identity?
Sure.
How that was influenced by other people?
Sure. I think I was really lucky. I think I was really lucky to meet specifically older queer folks who had radical politics in general, who had radical sexual politics, and who weren't scared to, you know, talk about that with a teenager. I look back at so much of what my life was like when I was in middle school and high school, and it's just like, it really drives home for me really what a risk a lot of the adults in my life were taking by hanging out with me. Just because there's always sort of so much questioning of, like, you know, oh, like, if a younger person and an older person are friends, like, obviously it's sexualized, obviously, like, something predatory is happening, and it just, like...
It happens quite a lot, actually, where younger members of the queer community, younger gay people, gay and lesbian, transgender people, will form these sort of familial bonds with older members of the community, and nobody likes to talk about it too much because of what you just said, the public perception. But it's almost like a necessary part of our building our sense of ourself.
I think that it is, and I mean, I think that, and I think this is different for folks like who are queer spawn or to specifically come from queer families and identify as queer, but. You know, for people who grow up queer and who are raised in straight families, like, there's...
The vast majority.
You know, which is the vast majority, like, there's not... There's not necessarily a lot of connection in common culture. And I think that because there is kind of this queer culture that it's... And also because a lot of queer folks come from homes that are, you know, disenfranchised, abusive, homophobic. I wasn't. I was lucky. But a lot of queer kids I know did grow up with that experience that, you know, a lot of us are just forced to find chosen family.
A lot of people come to San Francisco for that.
For that, yeah.
It's quite a cliche at this point.
Yeah.
Everybody here is from somewhere else.
Yeah.
And is struggling to build their chosen family network.
Yeah.
To rebuild their life in some way that, you know, looks ideal to them. I remember also not just about mentors in the queer community, mm-hmm. but also mentors in the leather community.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't on this show talked very much about SM and leather mm-hmm. culture in San Francisco
mm-hmm.
Until now, but you've been involved with the leather community
mm-hmm.
As a player, certainly. You've been a sex worker. You worked as a pro dom.
Mm-hmm.
How old were you when you first did that?
22? No, 21. 21.
You talked about having queer mentors when you were younger mm-hmm. for that identity, but also mentors as in the leather community.
Mm-hmm.
So what was that process like? Clearly you had to develop some skills before you became a pro dom.
Right.
And who was it that would you say was your mentor in that area?
I mean, I think this is a complicated question. I feel like it's important to mention here that I'm also a sexual abuse survivor, and I think that particularly for survivors of various kinds of violence and abuse, that, you know, and I'm a domestic violence survivor, and you spend a lot of time, once you're out of those situations, really relearning your boundaries and recalibrating your limits and figuring out what's okay and what's not and what feels safe and what doesn't. And for me, actually, sex work has always been a place where I'm able to really, like, have very clearly defined boundaries. And that's part of what's made it feel important and empowering to me. Wanted to state that. And I think that in terms of mentors, and I'm separating between SM community and sex work community, because, you know, how I play sort of within the SM world is actually very different from how I am in my sex work life.
Yeah.
And also mentors in the queer world, like, it wasn't so much, you know, that somebody, like, gave me this really awesome lesson in caning,
mm-hmm.
you know, or that somebody, like, taught me about piercing or whatnot. I mean, I certainly had some of those conversations with friends, but it was more that I met some folks, Carol and Robert among them, you know, among other people, who were just, it's going to sound cheesy, but, like, they taught me about limits. You know,
yeah.
Like, I met some friends who, when I was in a place where I was, like, very shell-shocked and very PTSD and very much, like, kind of in this victim mentality around a lot of the abuse that I'd suffered. And I met some folks who were like, no, you're a whole person. It's okay. You don't have to be a victim. And, like, here's how you set some boundaries. And that, more than anything, is really, I think, what allowed me to grow and to thrive and to then be able to, you know, set those boundaries within, like, having sex in general and set those boundaries with sex work and, yeah. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. So basically you're saying that you found the leather community and playing SM was a good way to learn boundaries
yeah.
and to learn a sense of taking control of your life.
Yeah.
And a sense of, you know, not to feel like you were the victim for the
yeah.
rest of your life. Like, it was okay, you had to deal with some of this stuff inside yourself. But this was a really good structured way to do that, to
yeah.
deal with these things and to learn about them.
And I will also say that, you know, as there are creeps in any community, like, there are creepy people with no boundaries in the SM community. There are creepy people with no boundaries in the queer community. And I think that also part of what I learned, particularly when I was first starting out playing, was sort of, like, really how to trust my gut and also how to, like, ask around about people. You know, like, I think that there is this sense of people taking care of each other, and I think that that's important, and I think that, like, sometimes that gets derided as gossip or he said, she said, but, you know, like, it's good to know. It's good to ask around.
Yeah.
And I really value that I'm in a community where I can do that, you know, like, hey, so I'm thinking about this person, you know, what do you know about them? Like,
we've got two things that are certain that seem to be emerging from the conversation, which is ones of identity and community. And building your own sense of yourself as you've grown up.
Right.
And you moved, went, so you started out with sort of a queer identity. Do you think that shaded naturally into your interest in SM?
I think so. Yeah.
Was that part of just living in this area and the fact that there's so much overlap?
I mean, I think I'd been having, you know, sort of kinky fantasies really for as long as I was aware of sex in my body and aware of sexuality. I think that I was also, you know, when I was initially coming out, I was so young and, I was in sixth grade. I was 11 and 12 and, you know, nobody was going to want to touch talking about sex with me with a 10-foot pole, right, particularly talking about SM. And the first few years that I was out, a lot of what I learned about queerness was from books. And, you know, some of those books were, like, really tragically second wave and very anti-SM and very anti-porn. You know, those elements of my sexuality were things that I definitely wrestled with for longer, I think, because of that early stuff. That said, you know, again, in San Francisco, there's a really, like, large vocal outleather community here, and that did, once I was ready to reconcile those desires, that did make that feel safer.
Yeah, and more than just a large vocal community, it is a community, which has a sense of standards, community standards about what behaviors are acceptable.
Exactly. Exactly.
And what behaviors are not acceptable, and a way of being, and a way of enforcing those norms in the traditional ways that small communities do.
Yeah.
You started playing SM when you were young, and that led you...
When
you were younger.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, you learned more boundaries and more skills, and you became a sex worker. Being a pro-dom... And
mostly modeling. When I was initially starting sex work, most of what I was doing the first couple of years was modeling.
In what sense?
Porn modeling, pinup. Uh-huh. That was when I was 19. And then I did like a couple of sessions as a pro dom when I was 21. The other thing is that my experience with sex work has not always been in a consistent timeline. I've advertised sometimes I've taken breaks, which I think is, again, another really important lesson that I've learned sort of from the community around me, which is, you know, if you absolutely can, like, have other work.
Mm-hmm.
Do something else. You know, sex work, I think, is important and can really be a gift for a lot of us, but it's also really intense work and it can really burn you out. So just, like, being able to space things out.
Going in and out of it is important.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and that's also, like, that is definitely a privilege that I have, like, as a white girl, as someone who went to college, as someone with middle-class privilege, like, not every sex worker can do that. I totally acknowledge that.
Yeah.
Not
every sex worker wants to.
True.
But it is definitely something you should consider. It is an intense field. I mean, I've done some work like that myself, as I think I've said in other places in these interviews.
Mm-hmm.
So you did mostly that modeling and things.
Mm-hmm.
As a survivor of child sexual abuse, did you say?
Child sexual abuse and domestic violence.
Domestic violence. You know, coming out of that sort of domestic situation, you found that playing SM or being in the leather community was useful to you, building your sense of boundaries, and having mentors teach you those boundaries. What was that process like? I mean, you met someone, you began exploring these fantasies, you began exploring the idea of actually playing SM?
This is the other thing. I feel like I started playing with SM, you know, and this is not how I recommend people do it.
Yeah.
But, like, I started playing with SM before I had a super clear sense of my boundaries. And, while I was still playing with some fairly sketchy people. So I think that some of it was kind of trial by fire. And a lot of it was also, you know, still having other community resources around and having people around to sort of, like, reflect back to me what I was saying. And, you know, like, well, Gina, you know, if that doesn't feel comfortable to you, like, you can say that. And, you know, this is really about you and your pleasure and that kind of thing.
Sort of telling you to take responsibility for your own desires or for, you know, your own limits.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't mean to shut down your answer.
No, it's fine. And I mean, I think also, just to say that, I mean, when I talk to other people about that kind of thing, particularly young women, particularly young queer people, and trans folks too, like, and specifically for those of us who are socialized as female, you know, like, we're not really taught to say no. We're also not really taught to say yes, you know, like, and I think that talking about consent and complicating consent is really important.
Complicating consent?
Complicating it just in terms of, like, you know, that no and yes are both good and both have equal value, and that a yes can feel just as good as a no, or a no can feel just as good as a yes.
Yeah, that you have a right to you have a right to your fantasies and your desires, but you also have a right to say no to things.
Exactly. And I think that particularly people who are raised as women in this culture aren't really taught that.
Do you think it's a sense of you are not taught to own your desires?
I think it's a sense of not being taught to own your desires. I think it's a sense of being taught to cater to other people's desires.
That your needs and your anything you might want is secondary to the
right.
people around you.
Right.
Specifically men, but generally everyone around
right.
you.
Right. You know, specifically men or family obligations or, you know, the sort of idea of, like, women being maternal and being caretakers and not sort of putting themselves first and... Yeah, and that kind of socializing can then bleed into a lot of fucked up relationships for our own boundaries and our needs.
Yeah, who would have thought that in the leather community there'd be a lot of fucked up relationships? It must be said that there are perhaps a larger percentage of abuse survivors are attracted to SM and the general leather community because that's where issues of power and control
right.
are specifically dealt with.
I don't even know that I would say that it's a larger percentage, though. I mean, I think that when you also look at percentages in general of, like, how many people are abuse survivors, I mean, the current numbers, the current statistics that people throw out, and this is just what's reported, so I would guess it's actually higher than this, is that a third of women, by the time they're 18, have been sexually abused in some way, and a fourth of men. That's a hell of a lot of people in the whole world, and that's just what's reported.
So you think we just discuss it more in the leather
community? I think that we discuss it more in the leather community. I don't think that it's any less prevalent in other communities. I think that it's just something that we discuss more within SM communities and within queer communities because we're used to talking about sex.
So you had a specific experience that you were sort of alluding to in your early life in your early experiences with SM where you realized that you needed to take control of your boundaries. Mm-hmm. Can you think of a moment or an example of when that became extremely particularly clear to you?
I think just when I was doing play that, like, that wasn't feeling healthy to me anymore. You know, it was this thing of, like, okay, I do still want to be playing. There is still a lot in this kind of sex and play that's really important to me. And, you know, then also some of the ways that I'm exploring this don't feel like I've got my sort of own best interests at heart. So it was just really about, like, keeping myself in check, remembering safety. Which, again, I think is something that, you know...
Well, how did you know that it was not... that it wasn't good for you?
Just how I felt.
When you finished?
Yeah.
So, how were you finding partners and people to play with at that point?
This is the other thing. I mean, at that point, I was, you know, like, finding folks online, wasn't really checking them out, you know. And I think that, again, I think that asking around about people is good.
Because
you learn a lot.
You were, you know, this happens to a lot of people. They have a desire to play, and so they just want to play, and it never occurs to them that they have something to learn.
Exactly. Well, I think that also there's this notion of sex and play and love and pleasure and all of these wonderful things that can happen to our bodies as being these scarce economies.
Mm.
So it's like, and I know that this is at least, you know, how I was when I was 19, 20. I was like, oh, like, I have no self-esteem. Nobody would ever like me. Oh, my God, this person wants to play with me. Well, obviously, I have to play with them, even if the little red flags in my mind are going off and they're making me feel creepy. Like, when am I going to have this opportunity again? So it's just that whole notion of, like, you know, of sex, of this particular kind of kinky sex, as being, like, this thing that, like, can only happen with this one person, and you're gonna do, like, all 27,000 things you've always wanted to do, because it's never gonna happen again, and it's just, like, yeah, and I mean, and I think that that's often how, I mean, it's at least how I came into SM. I have a feeling it's probably how other people come in, too, with this idea that, like, what you want is so weird and out there and intense and extreme that, you know, that you're going to be really damn lucky to find somebody who wants it. And it's just like, it's actually not like that. Yeah. You know, there's actually a whole community of people
That will want to play with you.
Yeah.
Or that will welcome you.
That will at least welcome you, you know.
And as you came into this community, as you met more people at, you know, I assume the way most of us do, at public events, semi-public events.
Yeah, public events, reading books, you know. I mean, I think another one of the lucky things about being in San Francisco is that a lot of folks who are really kind of outspoken and renowned within the SM community are here, you know, and are to a certain degree accessible. You know, like, I could go to a reading that Carol was doing and approach her afterwards and say, hey, like, I really like your work, you know, can I come volunteer at the center? Like, it really was that simple.
Yeah. And so you began to develop sort of friendships and relationships there that turned into play relationships and then mentoring kind of relationships.
Yeah. And that turned into, you know, oh, like, let's connect you with these people. You know, and I found that I was also, as I was gaining confidence, able to make those connections back. You know, like, I really think that when you have good people in your life, more good people start coming in.
Yeah. So you had the courage to follow your desires, but you also had the wisdom to tell the difference between people that were destructive to you and people that were more helpful or caring about you.
Right.
What were some of the early lessons that you learned from these people? You talked earlier about learning boundaries.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's all about that, but to spell it out a little more, learning to trust your gut. You know, if something feels weird and doesn't feel right, it's probably not right, and you can say no and you can back out at any time. You know, even if that means, like, at the cafe when you're meeting the person and they say something that feels a little off, you can trust that. You can get up and leave. You know, nice to have coffee, by now. Like, that kind of thing. I think, yeah, I mean, that's sort of the big example that comes to mind.
You know, learning to trust your gut. Like,
yeah.
That usually is the turning point, I think, for a lot of people, is to learn to trust that sense of fear.
Yeah.
Or not even, and being able to honor that to the point where you don't even have to name exactly what it is that's making you feel uncomfortable.
Exactly.
You just say, there's something about this person, so I'm going to make an excuse. And,
Yeah,
be like, polite, but
right, exactly, and like, really prioritizing your own safety and your own emotional, you know, and physical and whatever else, that kind of well-being over, you know, oh, like, I need to make nice and be nice to this person, and, you know, and sex is a scarce economy, so and I guess related to that also, around the whole scarce economy idea, like, really remembering and learning that kinky desires and kinky sex are not so weird and so out there and, you know, nobody's going to want to do this. Like, yeah. Just remembering that there is a community. There's a whole community of people.
Or, you know, even if there is temporarily a scarcity or a lack of people in your life to play with, that doesn't mean you should take unreasonable risks.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's something else we all... We all have to learn as we go along, you know, learning as we move more into the leather and SM communities.
Yeah. Sometimes, well, I think always that no sex is better than bad sex or, you know, or scary sex or scary in the bad way, I mean.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And then they're scary in the good way.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is what we call edge play. I mean, how long did that process take where you sort of felt like you had... you were a more responsible player, or you knew more about what you wanted?
I think that was all I, like, really... I don't know if I can quantify a time to it. I mean, I think that... I remember when things started changing for me, and I feel like once they started changing, like, the circle widened a lot, and...
Yeah, there is this sense that we get when you know you've entered the community.
Yeah.
You have a sense that you're sort of out there on the edge, and you can be at the exact same meeting with the same group of people, like an educational event, You can go to, say, the Society of Janus and one of their lectures. But you have this feeling that you are outside the group.
Right.
And then, but there is comes this certain moment or a certain sense of or feeling that we get when we suddenly realize that we've passed through some invisible membrane and we've joined the underground.
Mm-hmm.
Or we're part of the underworld.
Yeah.
You know, this idea that we're part of the community and that people know us and, you know, and that you have resources, people you can talk to about, and people and ways to check people out.
Yeah.
Now, what was that for you? Was that just developing a network of personal friendships, or was there a particular organization that you...
It was developing a network of personal friendships, and it was also, you know, developing that sort of internal sense of this feels okay, this doesn't feel okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that actually developing that, you know, I don't know how long and quantifiably took, maybe 6 months, you know, in terms of that kind of initial feeling, those initial feelings. But I also feel like, you know, like, I think everybody's people skills are improving all the time and are always changing, you know.
Especially at that point in your life when you're in your early 20s, say, late teens, early 20s. And that was when you were doing modeling, fetish modeling, of that kind. Do you? It's not really necessary to be part of the community to do that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a separate journey or a separate learning to get money for modeling for that kind of modeling?
Yeah, I think that sex work was a separate journey from kind of my queer journey and my SM journey, but that it was also all related. I mean, just because it all came back to sex for me.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, my sense of what I do as a sex worker versus how I play are pretty separate. And that's a pretty firm boundary for me, just in terms of, you know, what it feels good for me to sort of sell in that sex work persona versus... And I don't want to say, like, how I am in real life, because, I mean, sex work is real life, but, like, sort of how I am more authentically. I mean, I feel like sex work for me, at the end of the day, is a lot about performance, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, it has to be.
Yeah.
Because you're
being
dealing with people who may or may not have good boundaries.
Exactly.
You can't really allow yourself to let go. And you need to have a greater sense of boundaries when you're dealing with customers.
Exactly.
And, you know, they're total strangers.
Exactly.
So, how did you learn to be a pro dom?
That's fine. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of learning. You know, I feel like the sort of SM and DS skills that I felt like I would need, I already had in terms of play that I'd already done in my personal life, and so that was something that I could carry over. And I mean, then it was more just in terms of, like, any kind of sex work that you do with clients, you know, like, how do you place an ad? What kind of photos do you put up? You know, do you work out of a house? Do you work independently? Do you fuck with hotels? Like, just that kind of thing. So, and that, I think, was specifically something I learned from sex worker community, from other friends of mine who were in the business.
Yeah. Do you find that you made those decisions based on your personal preferences or based on more market forces? Or?
I think my bottom line is always my safety, you know, so, and is also, like, not undercharging.
Yeah, getting a fair price for your work.
Yeah, exactly. So I think mostly those choices have been based on personal preference and also sort of getting a sense from friends who I trust and whose work I trust, like...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you have a specific mentor, someone who taught you about the business?
A couple people, actually. One person who has done a lot of different kinds of work in the sex industry, and another person who was more working as a dancer and as a pro dom and didn't kind of do as multifaceted stuff.
Did you do, like, double dates or anything where you're going along on that.
Yeah, those are actually really helpful. Mm-hmm. And when I've worked independently, that's always what I've done, actually.
Oh, really?
And when I was working in houses, I would see clients alone. Mm-hmm. So,
how long did you work? You say houses, plural?
It was only one house. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So, what's it like to work as a pro dom in a house?
Yeah. I was only in one house, so this is the experience mm-hmm. of the house. It's. You know, clients are calling up and they've got an array of people to choose from mm-hmm. instead of particularly calling you because they've seen your ad and they like you. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, clients will call the house and will be like, ooh, I don't really know what I want. Who's there? You know, or it's, you know, I'm looking for this specific body type. I think that in general, at least for the house that I was working at, the clients who came to that house were less moneyed. You know, I mean, they still had, you know, like, expendable income, obviously, but we're sort of, like, I think in a different class bracket than folks who can, you know, afford independent people and, like, wait on the money for their hotel and whatnot.
It's something that not a lot of people think about. They think there's only one group. You know, if you're going to see a pro dom, that there's only one type
only
of person who
one
does
type
that.
Of person who goes.
And there's, you know, only one sort of level to that.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are different levels, and there are different... types of people, different type of body types, and different, all kinds of different specialties.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, in the same way that, like, there are all different kinds of people in the sex industry, I really think there are all different kinds of clients.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, someone would book an appointment with someone. Who's working out of the house.
Yeah, who's working out of the house that day. Mm-hmm. You know, so then there was often the kind of, like, funny flurry of, like, oh, they're getting here in 10 minutes, you know, mm-hmm. running in and out of the bathroom, putting on the makeup, you know, putting on the outfit, you know.
Yeah, that's something that comes up again and again when you talk to sex workers, is how much of a performance it is in terms of costuming and
you know,
having to put on the femme drag or, you know, whatever costume.
Right.
You know, but you don't sit around waiting, wearing latex, waiting for people knock on the door.
Right.
This is not a 24/7 gig, no matter how much people like to promote that fantasy.
Right.
That you know, it's not. You've got a client, so you put on the gear, and you suck up the personality, and try to get up the energy for the performance. Sometimes that can be a drag. Sometimes that can be easier. I know my personal experience. But you know, if someone has not, you know, seen a pro dom.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about negotiation, because negotiation is a big mm-hmm. issue playing in with people and seeing sex workers. Negotiation is a big issue when you are seeing a sex worker or you're playing in the SM community. Clear communication.
Yeah.
But it's especially important when you are seeing a professional dominatrix or dominant man, if that's your bag. How do you generally, like, obviously you get a lot of, as a professional, you get mm-hmm. people who don't have a lot of experience.
Yeah, it was interesting. I either had clients who knew exactly what they wanted, or who were just kind of like, to be dominated. And I think that that's also interesting in terms of sort of the structural power within, like, a pay-for-play scene. Like, okay, so you're paying to be dominated. You're here for a specific reason. Like, and oftentimes those guys would want something really specific, and it was like, well, you're bottoming, but you're kind of not bottoming. I mean, this is kind of like a weird, like, kind of topping from the bottom, like, you know. And I wonder sometimes if that was in part where the motivation to do it, you know, to do it with someone you were paying as opposed to someone who you were just playing with came from.
So you don't. Yeah. So you think perhaps the clients didn't really want to give up control?
Yeah.
They wanted.
I mean, I'm sure that some of them did, but.
And just couldn't find anyone to play with.
Right. You know, but I think that there's also this kind of, like, you know, I want to be dominated in these, you know, 87 very specific ways within an hour, you know, and do this three times, and, like, yeah, it's just, you know, and the way, and again, in terms of sort of drawing the lines between, like, my professional life and my personal life, I mean, the way that I play in my personal life is just so much more fluid and so much more like, oh, okay, you like these specific things, like, let's, like, find a moment and find some chemistry and just see what happens and where it goes. And, yeah. Well, you know, that it's not as scripted.
Yeah. Also, you know, when you're doing it professionally, it's less important that you have your own... That it'd be something that you're interested in.
Exactly.
I mean, there's always that fantasy that that the client has that you're really into it also.
Right.
And they're hoping that you're enjoying it
right.
as much as they are. But it's not really as important that your particular fantasies get fulfilled.
Exactly.
And when you're negotiating to play in person, it's more finding out what you two have in common. Whereas when you're dealing with a client, you're trying to sort of extract information from them.
Yeah.
Or get a sense of a general thing.
Right.
So how do you go about doing a negotiation with a client? Somebody walks in. I mean, I just want to be dominated.
Right.
How do you draw people out?
I mean, I think that often how I would draw people out is like, well, are you more submissive? Are you more bratty? Like, if we're talking about DS, like, do you want to talk back? Do you want to be good? Do you want to be bad? Like, sort of talking about archetypes in some way. And then also asking, like, so you want to be dominated? Are you a masochist? Do you like sadists? Do you not like pain? Like, is what you're here for strictly about, you know, that kind of emotional and psychological feeling, or is there a physical element to it too?
And then getting them to maybe suggest some specific
right.
activities.
Specific activities, specific things, yeah.
And, you know, take care of the money parts, and then... You go on and play from there. Well, it looks like we're running out of time.
Okay.
So I want to say thank you very much for being on Underworld and for talking about such a wide range of topics in your own personal life. I'm building a catalog here of queer lives and queer experience, or just, you know, perverts in general. And, you know, as we say in the show, not everybody who looks normal always is normal.
I like that as a tagline.
And that concludes the third episode of Underworld. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Gina DeVries as much as I did. Sorry that putting together this show has taken me so long that all the upcoming events that we mentioned have already gotten by us. But the SFINX, the Sphinx shows, are ongoing, and you can find out more about them at sfinx.com, and I'm sure you can also reach Gina there directly. And as usual, you can check out my website, gentlemanjunkie.com, for show notes or to leave a comment on this episode. Feedback is always appreciated, although a little slow in coming, I have to mention. Or you can drop me an email at gentlemanjunkiejack@hotmail.com, or even call and leave a message at 206-666-4119. That's it from me, reminding you, as always, that just because somebody looks normal doesn't always mean that they are normal.